Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 26th of August. The protesters in Ferguson, Missouri met with a militarized police force, and we have learned that these units, many with high-powered weaponry, tanks, armored vehicles, and some with drones, are widespread in this country. The ACLU released a report in June of this year, War Comes Home, the Excessive Militarization of American Policing. It's an analysis of thousands of documents from police departments around the country. We'll spend this hour talking about the issue and a couple others because so much that the ACLU is involved with is current news, including a story from today. So we'll talk a little bit about some of those stories as well. But we've been wanting to look at the militarization of police for a long time, and so today we will. Chris Homedy is our guest. Chris is the longtime executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Chris as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Hello, Chris. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here again.
Nice to have you here. This is a busy time for you, and I do want you to comment because today the 7th U.S. Circuit Court in Chicago was hearing oral arguments on same-sex marriage in Wisconsin. You've been working on that issue for a long time. Can you give us an update?
Sure. The ACLU and the ACLU of Wisconsin back in February of this year filed a challenge to Wisconsin State constitutional ban barring same-sex marriages. In June, federal judge Barbara Crabb in Madison struck down that constitutional provision, saying that it violates equal protection in the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The state appealed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. And this morning, we had oral arguments before a three-judge panel, and the ACLU, our case, from the only one from Wisconsin, was heard at the same time as three cases from Indiana. For the sake of moving things along, I think the court wanted to hear those at the same time. So there were 80 minutes of oral argument this morning. The panel was Judge Posner, Judge Hamilton, Judge Williams. You don't want to speculate about where the judges stand, but I think that that's a decent panel for us, a good panel for us. And so now that oral arguments occurred, the judges are going to take all that information into account and could come up with a ruling, either affirming or reversing Judge Crabb's great decision from the Western District here in Wisconsin. And when that happens, whoever loses is almost certain to do one or two things. Ask the full Court of Appeals, not just a three-judge panel, but more than three judges, the whole panel to review it, or ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review the decision. We're confident that we've presented a very strong case. We have Judge Crabb's decision to work from. And we'll see what happens. But, you know, I'm not in a position to really speculate about what's going to happen mm-hmm. and when the decision is going to come down. I suspect it's going to come down sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm. And do you imagine that it will go before the Supreme Court sooner rather than later?
It's hard to say whether the Wisconsin and or Indiana cases will be the ones that get to the U.S. Supreme Court. There's lots of these cases around the country. And district courts, federal district courts, have been striking down similar laws in other states all around the country. The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes Utah and Oklahoma, has already ruled that the Utah law is unconstitutional. The 4th Circuit, which includes Virginia, has already ruled that Virginia's law violates the Constitution. The 6th Circuit, which I believe sits in Cincinnati, includes Ohio and Kentucky and some other states, has heard oral argument but hasn't ruled yet. Mm. So the 7th Circuit in Chicago, our Court of Appeals circuit, is a little behind in terms of the timing. But that's not to say that it isn't possible that the Wisconsin-Indiana cases couldn't go to the U.S. Supreme Court. The court may decide to take more than one decision from an appeals court, from appeals courts.
Yeah. All right. We'll have to talk about that issue down the road a little bit. All right. Militarization of the police force. The what we all witnessed day after day after day in Ferguson, Missouri, had some people thinking this is an aberration. This is excessive use of military, the assault weapons, the tear gas. But evidently from your report, there's a lot of militarization going on in police forces all over the country. When we when you think of the word militarization, Chris, what does it mean?
When I think of militarization of police forces, I wonder if there hasn't been a change in mission or change in culture, change in attitude. For the longest time, people thought of police as those who protect and serve. You know, honorable public servants who do a great job and are really part of the community. And, you know, they may not be, be perfect, but they really do a great service to their community and they're part of it. Militarization, that makes you think more of people who view the citizens, the residents of a community, not as their friends and neighbors, but as the enemy. Because militarization, you're getting implements of war, you're using tactics that are very aggressive and result in the a massive display of force. So it's really a different kind of mindset. I suspect a lot of your listeners remember George Carlin's routine about the difference between football and baseball.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And, you know, football is, you know, in the soldier's field or whatever. I'm not, you know, don't want to reduce the serious issue to a George Carlin routine. But really, I think it does raise the issue that there's a different kind of mindset. When you have people that want to be part of a SWAT team, a special weapons and tactics team, get to put on black uniforms and all this heavy equipment, get an M16 rifle, that's not what most police officers do during the day. When they're on duty. This is really something special. And you wonder if the officers who want to be on the SWAT team don't have a different kind of interest in what they're doing. Frankly, for some, I think it appeals to their sort of male hormones and let's be a warrior mentality. And in some limited, highly regulated circumstances, SWAT teams, military tactics and equipment are appropriate. But when it becomes so widespread, when it comes up in so many circumstances where all they're doing really is serving a search warrant, you know, the ACLU report, The War Comes Home, most SWAT teams are deployed to serve search warrants. Not because there's some guy with a high-powered rifle who's barricaded in his home taking shots at the neighbors, but really the SWAT teams are being used in the failed war on drugs.
Hmm. And they're pretty widespread. You talk about the number of such teams and all of this armor and sometimes even drones that are in more than just a few police departments in the country.
Right. The ACLU report talks about how there are 500 police departments that have mine-resistant vehicles, armored vehicles. And that's sort of, you know, the ultimate when it comes to this military equipment right now. But if you look at other departments, but it's not just 500. That you know, if that was all, it may not be too bad. But it's much more widespread than that. Back in 2001, before 9/11, the Cap Times, the Capital Times, a paper in Madison, did a survey of police departments in Wisconsin and found out that 83 SWAT teams existed. They weren't all called SWAT teams, but they were there. And they were in larger cities, in smaller cities, even in some tiny rural places. And so it's not a new phenomenon. This has been going on for quite a while. And it's been encouraged and abetted by the federal government for quite a while, really since 1990. And so now it's very pervasive, and lots of agencies around the state have SWAT teams, have military-type equipment, and whether it's within their own departments or they have access to it through drug task forces and multi-jurisdictional groups or whatever, it's really out there. The Gannett newspaper, Wisconsin folks, principally reporters at the Appleton Post-Crescent, recently did a study of a program of the U.S. Department of Defense that sells dirt cheap or even gives away military-type equipment to local law enforcement agencies. And they found that within the last decade, 219 approximately Wisconsin police agencies have gotten military-style equipment. $28 million worth of this equipment in the past decade. And it's everything from boots and socks and to body armor to grenade launchers and armored vehicles and helicopters. I think Kenosha got a helicopter. So it's been around for a long time, but it's really increased. It started out with the war on drugs in the early 90s. Then it got into a new phase after 9/11, and now we're after terrorists, and every community in Wisconsin had to have a SWAT team or military equipment to defend us against terrorists, and it's continued on. And so when mistakes are made, we're having more mistakes. When you're wasting money, we're perhaps wasting more money. It's really grown, and right now, people may have become aware of it because what was on display in Ferguson, Missouri, following the police shooting of Michael Brown, but it really has been there. And if, it's a terrible incident that happened down in Ferguson, and regardless of who's to blame or not, your heart has to go out to the family. But if something good can come of this, if it can get the dialogue going, get a debate going about what we expect and need our police to do, maybe that's something.
Well, it's hard to believe, Chris, that all of this has been going on as long as your report indicates it's been going on. And it takes an incident like the horrible police presence in Ferguson that makes us think, wait a second, for the first time we're realizing, I think many of us, how our police departments have changed, how much money is involved, as you say, how many mistakes have been made. And it's taken us 20 darn years to look at this issue? Are you serious? Why so long? Shouldn't we be involved in how our police departments operate?
Well, certainly citizens should be concerned about how their police departments operate. But, they're bureaucracies. They have institutional concerns and organizational concerns. And also remember, for the longest time, really since the war on drugs, if not before, the politicians have been into sort of a tough on crime mode, and you can't, say anything that would suggest perhaps that police need to be smarter in what they do and be more careful of how they use their resources and keep us safe without violating constitutional rights.
So do you believe that Eric Holder, of course, now has said we need to look at this? The president has said we need to look at this. Do you anticipate there will be some change?
I think we'll look at it. I don't know how much change there might be. Remember that Attorney General Holder is only going to be there as Attorney General for so much longer.
Right.
And that's an issue that's come up in terms of police misconduct investigations from the U.S. Department of Justice here in Milwaukee in in Madison and other places, there have been calls for such investigations, and they really haven't been forthcoming in the way that families and advocates would like to see. So I think the Attorney General and the President are right to identify this issue as worthy of their attention, and I think that they'll use their resources, which are somewhat limited, to get the conversation going. But I don't know that things will change. You mm-hmm. know, there's really conflicting interests here. Of course, people want to be safe, and the ACLU recognizes that, and ACLU members want to be safe. But the public real and the politicians and the public really have stepped back and not engaged law enforcement in a real conversation about how to be smart in keeping us safe, asking why can't we have public safety and respect for civil liberties and civil rights.
Mm-hmm. The other issue, of course, that came front and center is the issue of police and race in this country. And the story after story after story that you heard, it was interesting to hear every reporter in Ferguson saying, I haven't met anybody who hasn't had a negative encounter with the police over the years. They've been stopped time and time again for ridiculous reasons. Traffic violations that put them in jail, even though they've got young children to take care of, and it's a fine for a parking ticket or something. I mean, just really brutal treatment, and it's of a community of people of color.
Right. Certainly the militarization of the police, when you see how it's played out, it is disproportionately directed towards communities of color. Some of that is because the war on drugs is disproportionately directed towards people of color. Your listeners may remember that several months ago, the ACLU put out a report that indicated the incredible racial disparities when it comes to marijuana arrests.
Right.
Wisconsin is right up there in terms of states where there's racial disparity in marijuana arrests. So policing, the criminal justice system, there are issues with racial disparity and bias. Now, every institution in America, I would say, has issues with racial disparity and bias. Nobody is, immune from prejudice. And if you look, you'll find it just about everywhere. So I'm not saying that police departments, police officers, police chiefs are bad people and inherently biased. But when you look at the consequences of their actions, maybe the clerk at the grocery store is biased and he looks around when a black person comes in and thinks they're going to shoplift and follows them around or something. Well, that's pretty awful in terms of the that incident and the emotion and the bias that you had there. But the person's going to be able to shop and they're going to go. If you have a biased police officer who doesn't follow his training, doesn't follow what he's been told to do, but allows that bias to influence the interaction, the consequences can be deadly.
So how do you make sure that doesn't happen?
That's what everybody asks, and it's a $64,000 question that people have been asking for a long time. Some people have suggested that there's, a technology fix. Let's get police body-mounted cameras or whatever.
Right.
In Milwaukee, that we have the police fatal shooting of Dontre Hamilton on April 30th, which is still unresolved, and people are in the streets protesting mm-hmm. about that. Some people, including a couple aldermen, have suggested that body-mounted cameras are the answer to that. And people down in Ferguson have said the same thing. I've seen media reports that, if only the Ferguson police had body cameras, this wouldn't have happened. I don't think it's that simple. Part of the militarization of the police is the increasing use of high technology. So as the military changes, And now you hear about drone strikes taking out somebody in Yemen or whatever. Now you hear about police in the U.S. chomping at the bit to use drones here, maybe not militarized zones, but using drones here and other technology. And so a technological fix to bias in police departments, that may play a role in mitigating, but there's all sorts of things that need to be done. You know, we could have a long discussion about the pros and cons of cameras, body cameras, cop cams, if you will. But I think the important thing is to remember that we shouldn't get fixated and think that technology will help. Dash cams. You know, we've had in squad car cameras for a long time, and we know that they don't work perfectly. Sometimes the video goes missing. Sometimes you have video that seems pretty clear, but you can't get a jury to accept it as evidence that criminal charges should be brought. And with all these technologies, whether it's a flash bang grenade or a rocket launcher or some very sophisticated kind of use of drones and high-def photography, you have to be sure that you have policies in place and training that's adequate and accountability, and it's not going to be a fix. You also get people saying, we need more diversity in our police departments.
Right.
We need more diversity in our police departments. And Milwaukee Police Department, for instance, has a ways to go there. They're not bad today, but when you look at the classes that are entering the police academy, I think there's more work to be done. And you particularly wonder what's going to happen with leadership in the department several years from now in terms of diversity. Diversity is a good thing. It in all organizations, it makes you stronger. It brings a different perspective. It's a good thing. But it's not going to end police misconduct. It's not going to have police officers stay in a protected mode serve and not slip into, that's the other or that's even the enemy. Because frankly, African-American officers, Hispanic officers, when they get on the force, had the same pressures and exposed to the same cultural bias as any other officer. So, yes, we need diversity, but that's not the answer either. To some extent, the answer is going to be societal, not within police departments. And we have to do a lot of things to approach society's ills, and we have to acknowledge that police departments can't fix everything. You know, here in Milwaukee, for instance, there's tremendous concentrations of poverty,
yes.
Unemployment. There's a whole litany of things you can go through. The Milwaukee Police Department can't fix all that,
mm-hmm.
but it has to have a style of policing that recognizes it. Right now in Milwaukee, for the years we have data, like 2012 and going back, the police engaged in over 200,000 officer-initiated stops. These aren't responding to calls for service. These are officer-initiated traffic and pedestrian stops.
Over what
stops.
Time period, Chris?
Every year.
Okay.
Per year. And, of course, this is a city with somewhat less than 600,000. And so here we've got a policing strategy that, was place-based for deployment, and you wonder if that really is appropriate given the circumstances and whether it's even effective. And in other communities around Wisconsin, there have been incidents of police misconduct, and they may not be the result of policies and strategies, but there's certainly bias that's in other communities. In Milwaukee suburbs, in Madison, there's bias policing, and there's what used to be called racial profiling or driving while black. And very often it takes the form of race out of place profiling. So an African-American person drives from the south side of Madison to, I don't know, Fitchburg or some such place. They don't belong in Fitchburg, so they're going to get the attention of the police. Mm-hmm. Remember the ACLU report that I mentioned about racial disparities in marijuana arrests? And Wisconsin as a whole is pretty bad, but actually, Milwaukee is not as bad when it comes to racial disparities in marijuana arrests as Waukesha. Waukesha is incredible. And, you know, I haven't run the data, so I don't want to malign Waukesha unfairly. But it's not unreasonable to expect that perhaps some of that racial disparity is because there's race out of place profiling going on in Waukesha. You know, outside of the city of Waukesha, if you're a minority person, maybe the police officers are wondering what you're doing there.
Mm. Let's welcome phone calls. Chris Amity is our guest this hour, and we wanted to do an hour on militarization of police departments around the country, and we're going a little bit beyond that because you have to take into account how policing is done, the issue of race, racial disparity in terms of sentencing for similar crimes. The ACLU released a report that was before Ferguson. It was in June of this year, War Comes Home, the Excessive Militarization of American Policing. And we're talking about that this hour. It is on our Facebook page. So if you go to the Kathleen Dunn Show, the report is there as well, along with some documents from the ACLU. Here's our phone number. What do you make of all of this when you hear about how police departments have billions of dollars worth of this equipment? Does it lend itself to a certain mindset that is more military rather than the police are on your side, we're trying to help you? Does it set up an antagonistic role? Should we have some say over how our police departments are run and whether or not we want armored vehicles and armor and drones, for that matter, in our communities? Chris is the executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. We have many of them for Chris, and we start our calls with Mike in Racine. Hi, Mike.
Hi. You know, we really have to separate the use of military-style hardware, military surplus hardware, from the actions of the police officers that are using that hardware. This military-style hardware, especially when people have been misusing the term tanks. There are no tanks that have been supplied to the police department. We have these mine-resistant vehicles and other armored personnel carriers. These are vehicles which a large number of them, I can't speak for all of them, but a large number of them are not just given to the police departments. They're there under a lease program where essentially they get it at no cost. As long as they maintain it, and it's subject to recall if the military needs that hardware in a future conflict. And I'm telling you, I want my police to be protected. I want those vehicles to be available to the local police departments instead of sitting on a parking lot somewhere in the middle of the desert waiting for the next war. These vehicles are highly useful, not just for armed situations, but you know, they're chemical resistant. You know, they're a lot of them are designed to be sealed up. They can go into hazmat situations where no other vehicle that a police department normally has access to has the ability to get close to dangerous situations where we are paying these people to put their bodies in harm's way. And why we would begrudge them the best equipment that's available, I just don't understand that logic whatsoever. I completely, completely do not like what this guest is suggesting, that having this military-style hardware is driving a mindset. That's crazy talk.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. Chris?
Well, I feel like get ready for some more crazy talk. But, Mike, I think we actually agree more than you'd expect, and it's really a matter of degree. I don't remember saying that there shouldn't be any military equipment given to local police departments. I thought I was saying that it needs to be used properly and that there need to be some regulations. So I think that it's perfectly appropriate for some law enforcement agencies to have mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicles, but not every agency needs to have one. Not every little agency needs to have one. I think it would be good if there was like one for Kenosha County, one for Milwaukee County, one for maybe Vilas and Forest and a few others. So I don't think I ever said that there aren't any legitimate uses for this. I was saying, why are they used for drug busts and search warrants when maybe only a little contraband is found, and that's all that you could reasonably expect to be there? I was talking about how if there's some guy who's barricaded with a high-powered rifle shooting at his neighbors, well, that's the time to use it. So I think actually we agree. It's just a matter of a difference of degree about how much these things should be used. Whether or not they contribute to a mindset, I can point you to newspaper articles where former law enforcement people, sheriffs from Wisconsin, have talked about how they're disturbed that they attract guys who want to dress up in black. And so it's not just me who is saying that, but it's people from law enforcement who have seen this. And that's not to say that the guys who are on SWAT teams are bad guys or whatever, but what they need are good guidance and supervision. And ACLU is recommending that local law enforcement make sure they have policies and training in place so that deployment is done in a way where it makes sense. So you just don't send it out because you're going to arrest some guy who's got a small amount of drugs, perhaps. But really decide when you're going to do it, how it's going to be supervised. We've got no problem with that. You know, you may not believe it, but the ACLU really encourages good professional law enforcement, because we know if you have good professional law enforcement, then more likely important American values like the Fourth and Fifth Amendment are going to be protected.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. Let us go to Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
I think since 9/11 and the Patriot Act, which basically stripped all Americans of a lot of rights, the government realized that it could really do anything it wanted to control the population, which is now Walmart workers. And Walmart workers might be a little angry about not sharing a big feast that's going on at the top in this country. And they are truly terrified that a little spark like Ferguson, Missouri, could ignite this entire country of poor people to say, we want some of these riches just the way you folks have them. But they also know that they have us dumbed down and terrified of this enemy in overseas, the terrorists, and that we allow our government to torture those people. They're not even human beings in a majority of Americans' minds. So in a way, they're turning that against us, the population. They're monitoring every digital thing you do, where you walk with your smartphone. Everything possible is being recorded.
Ray, thank you very much for the call. Let me take a part of that and move it more toward this sense that those communities where there are racial issues, and there are many of them in this country, and certainly Milwaukee is one of them, that a lot of people saw what happened in Ferguson. They looked at how the police responded to Occupy. They have thought about demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations. I mean, it's all part of the collective consciousness. But in terms of racial issues, that you're just waiting for some other community to explode, which could happen because things are not very good in a lot of these communities, and you would have this incredible thing in place to sort of put down a protest. And that's something we haven't talked about yet, that these are being used to squelch protest in this country as well, some of which seems to be quite legitimate.
The ACLU had quite a presence on the ground in Ferguson. You know, the ACLU Missouri is right there in St. Louis, and the national experts from ACLU were able to help and advise. And the police in Ferguson and St. Louis County really were inept in their response to the shooting, and then particularly the protests.
Right.
You know, I've got no problem if there's violence going on with police having adequate resources and riot gear and mm-hmm. and all the rest. But in the initial response, it was like, we're going to demonstrate how powerful and forceful we are. And I really don't think that the Ferguson police officials and some other St. Louis County police officials had a clue as to what was on the minds of people in the neighborhood. So they did things which are pretty beyond the pale in terms of civil liberties. For instance, they said, you can't take photographs of police. Well, you can take photographs of police. And the ACLU in Ferguson had to go in and sort that out. And after a while, we got them to rescind their order to, prohibit people from taking pictures of police. And that was a nice thing to do, but we shouldn't have had to do that. You know, it's so well settled in the law that you can take a picture of a police person as long as you don't obstruct or get mm-hmm. between them and the suspect or whatever. And then they started detaining journalists, mm-hmm. you know, just talk about handling a situation badly. So hopefully police departments in other communities where there may be some racial tension because of racial disparities and concentrations of poverty and all that can happen in so many of America's urban centers and rural places and suburban places too. Hopefully those departments will learn from what happened, the mistakes in Ferguson, and realize that they need to be more transparent, more cooperative, an understanding of community sentiment. I'm not saying that they should abide law-breaking or anything like that, but certainly they could be more professional and savvy than the people in Ferguson were.
Let's go to Scott in Juneau County. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen and Chris. Thank you very much for the program. Two callers ago, Mike did alleviate some of my concerns about FEMA. I hope you can relate to this, too. Over the last year or so, I've seen an awful lot on the Internet about the militarization of FEMA. Now, that, to me, adds another layer of concern because it's so centralized in our nation. But a lot of the same types of vehicles we're talking about, huge numbers of, military vehicles and other equipment, and making it, at least on the internet, what I saw was made it look like, the national government's going to invade all the, the country and going to take everything over, and when you lose all your rights and under martial law, that's what it is. I would rather see it in the hands of the local people, just like in the National Guard, instead of calling it National Guard, to have it, a state militia, it's like, so that's a whole nother issue. So.
Scott, I use the internet a lot, and, I do research a lot, but I'm sure you understand and listeners understand that you can't believe everything that's on the internet, and you need to verify or confirm some of the things that appear to be going on that are suggested by internet sites. One of the issues that comes up when you have this militarization and the fact that police need M16s and all the rest is the proliferation of high-powered weapons among the citizens mm-hmm. of our country. And the Second Amendment has been interpreted to allow that. Congress has failed to do anything about regulating assault rifles. So you really have got people out there who believe that the government is out to get them and that they need to arm themselves. You know, everybody knows, and it's not an urban legend, that after Obama was elected, gun sales shot up. So the response to having we can't have an arms race between citizens and the police and the military. The military weapons that some police departments have, sure, we don't want to have them outgunned by drug cartels and all the rest. But we also can't have an arms race between our own citizens and our own police.
Chris Amity is our guest. We have an interesting comment from Scott on Facebook, which is a really good point, and we'll get to that in just a moment, as well as many phone calls as possible. We're talking about an ACLU report released pre-Ferguson in June of this year, War Comes Home, the Excessive Militarization of American Policing. Chris Amity is executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Chris, here's an important comment from Scott on Facebook. Arms and armor are tools that increase police capability in responding to calls. What's the research that shows that more arms and armor has led to more unjustified deaths or to more inappropriate use of force? I'm not talking about anecdotal evidence, but actual system reviews comparing pre- and post-militarization of the police force. Arms and armor cannot use themselves.
If we zero in on Wisconsin here, as I mentioned, the use of military equipment has been going on for a long time, and there have been mistakes. In the 2001 report in the Capital Times that I mentioned, it describes a situation that went very badly in Green Lake County. The same survey by the Cap Times talks about how there were increasing numbers of these kinds of mistakes. So perhaps we can get out on the internet and find specific figures, but from what I know of what's happening in Wisconsin, there are problems. And some of these issues are almost endemic. Like, there's always a level, it seems, of police officer-involved shootings. But then I think there are trends where you see that there is the equipment out there that is increasing the potential and actual number of problems where things go wrong. Now, of course, there are also situations that go right, and I don't grudge the police of having the ability to deal with the guy who's barricaded and shooting at his neighbors with the high-powered rifle. But when you look at the potential for these kinds of mistakes and you sort of balance the benefits, if the benefit is catching some guy who's got a small amount of contraband versus putting people's lives in danger, you know, you've got to wonder. And too often SWAT teams are deployed when there may be children or the elderly in a home. There's a sort of an infamous case that involves a Wisconsin family. There's a Laotian family from near Madison. Their home had a terrible fire, so they moved down to an Atlanta suburb to be with their relatives while they sort of were getting their lives back together. Suburban police in a SWAT team invaded their home, even though there were children's toys in the yard, so that the police knew that there were children present, and They were after some cousin who was considered a drug dealer or whatever. So the police come in, and the SWAT team comes in with the M16s and all the rest. They throw a flashbang grenade that lands very near to a toddler's crib. It's Baby Boo Boo. That's the little boy's name. When the parents finally get reconnected with the toddler, he's in the hospital in a medically induced coma. There's injury to his face and his chest. And when you sort of balance the benefits versus the risk, you know, even if you don't have an exact number of the times when something goes wrong and the trend of whether things go wrong, we know that it is a problem, and the consequences of making a mistake can really be tragic. Fortunately, the baby is recovering, and the family is back in Madison. But these kinds of things happen, and you know, is catching that cousin who was arrested later at another place without incident, without a SWAT team, I don't think. You know, is that really so important that we would risk children and elderly and innocent people in these operations?
Let's go to Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Hi. I just would like to raise the point, so far in all of the discussions that I've been hearing on WPR regarding the militarization of local police forces, I haven't heard anybody address who's profiting from this, basic giveaway of military equipment to local police forces, and presumably all of that equipment is being replaced. Who's profiting? Has anybody followed the money trail?
I don't know if all that equipment is being replaced. Excuse me. A lot of it is kind of surplus, because remember, we've been at war for the last 10, 12, whatever number years here. And civil liberties don't do well when we're at war. There's lots of things that happen that tend to undermine civil liberties and civil rights. So, you know, at the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, Department of Defense, the agencies that are either loaning or selling or giving this equipment, depending on what the equipment is, to local law enforcement agencies, it's certainly in their interest to do something with this equipment. Whether or not it necessarily benefits local police departments, whether it helps their budgets at all, it's unclear. Because if they don't need this stuff, you know, it's not like it's fulfilling a need that was already identified and existing. This is something new. So I don't know that the local law enforcement agencies are actually benefiting from this in a financial situation, unless you start getting into the whole other issue that we probably don't want to get into today about civil asset forfeiture and drug cases, and how, you know, that has the perverse incentive to have police departments focus on the war on drugs in ways that raise money and get for those departments.
Yeah. Well, we have only about a minute, so I am tempted to take more phone calls, but I think that I probably won't. Chris, thank you so much for being with us. You're also, to move into a completely different topic, voter ID is also, that's on your plate today too, right?
The ACLU of Wisconsin has been very busy in the last couple of years, and not that we haven't been working very, very hard for a long time. But besides marriage equality, which was at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals today, all these policing issues that we're dealing with around the state, there's also the issue of photo ID. And ACLU has one of the four cases that challenged the Wisconsin photo ID law, Act 23. Two of those cases were recently disposed of by the Wisconsin Supreme Court when they rewrote a rule that would allow to go. Our federal case is still going on. Oral arguments in the 12th Circuit on September 12th.
Thank you. Chris Almody, our guest this hour. Chris is the executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin. Their report is War Comes Home, the Excessive Militarization of American Policing. It's on our Facebook page where you can read all of it. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up. We'll return and talk about whether or not there's something else out there.